KALW.
From KALW News in San Francisco, this is Cross Currents. Context, culture, and connection from around the Bay Area.
Mission District.
Fremont.
El Cerrito.
O-Town, baby.
Lake Merritt.
Temescal.
Coming up, a man seeking asylum in San Francisco was arrested by immigration agents.
So you don't arrest somebody from the asylum office where asylum seekers would have protection.
We'll consider what this means for asylum seekers. Then we hear from African-American teens in Oakland about their experiences of sexual harassment and assault at school.
African-American girls, like, it happens to us so often, like, it is a part of our daily lives.
And we'll hear what Oakland Unified leaders are doing about it.
We need women leaders and then non-women leaders to actually come together and look at ways that we are supporting girls.
Stay tuned. Cross Currents is next. Last week in San Francisco, a man entered a government office in the Soma District for an asylum interview. Omar Abdelmajid, who also goes by Omar Zeidan, lives in San Jose, but he's from Sudan. He said he'd been arrested and tortured in that country for demonstrating about democracy. The conversation in the asylum interview lasted about 2 hours. When it was over, he was told there were more questions, and these would come from immigration and customs enforcement agents. Soon after, Zeidan was arrested, handcuffed, and detained for overstaying a visa. We've got many questions about this case. First, should asylum seekers feel safe when sharing their stories? Are ICE agents justified in holding Zeidan while they investigate his case? And what's next? KALW's Ben Trefney reached Jamila Abdelhalim, a Sudanese attorney and immigration consultant, to learn more.
Is it unusual for ICE to arrest someone at an asylum hearing?
Yes, it's very unusual. It's very unusual and very unprecedented. And I've never heard of anything like that. And all the lawyers and the attorneys that I speak, as I've spoken with, they've never come across a situation like this. Because when you apply for asylum, that means that you are protected and you're at a pending asylum status until your asylum case is being adjudicated. And if you overstay your visa, you apply for asylum, you should be protected, because according to the asylum law, you have up to 1 year to apply for asylum. So in the meantime, your status could have changed, and a lot of people overstay their visa. They're undocumented. They're out of status, and they can still apply for asylum if they have reasons, compelling reason to apply for the asylum. So that's very unheard of.
And this is, an immigration system right now that is extremely overloaded with cases, whether it's people who are undocumented or documented trying to get into the country, is overwhelmed. There isn't enough funding for it. So I can imagine that there are many people who, while they're waiting, are actually not here in legal status in the meantime.
Basically, that's what it is, because, for example, I think in Omar's case, he's waited for 3 years for the asylum interview.
So when somebody like Mr. Zeidan is in an asylum hearing, what takes place? It was almost a two-hour conversation that he had before he was detained. What were they talking about?
Well, the process is like after you apply for asylum, you go for an asylum interview. This process is called affirmative asylum, as opposed to the other kinds of asylum where you apply at the borders or at the immigration court, things like that. So the affirmative asylum process is you go for an interview in front of an asylum officer, in an office that has jurisdiction over your address or your area of residence. And this is your opportunity to tell your story of how and why you are applying for asylum, what are the reasons for you leaving the countries and not willing to go back to your country. So they will ask a lot of information about your background and then your asylum claim. Why are you applying for asylum? What happened to you? What kind of persecution you faced? And they will try to verify this information. And also they will tell the person about the process of the case, what's going to happen from that point going on, what anticipated decision will be. Usually they give you a letter to come back in a couple of weeks and receive your decision. And the decision can either be a grant of asylum if the officer was convinced of your case and believed your story or your persecution story, or it could be a referral to an immigration judge. this is an issue of like credibility, an issue of like criminal background, inadmissibility, things like that. So there is a process for that. So you don't arrest somebody from the asylum office where it's supposed to be like a place where asylum seekers would have protection.
That's Jamila Abdelhalim. She's a Sudanese attorney and immigration consultant. I mean, it does seem like when somebody goes in to seek asylum that they need to share as freely and openly as they possibly can in order to get the honest, truthful story there in front of the officials. And so if ICE goes into an asylum office, then that could really undermine the trust that asylum seekers might place in the U.S. government.
Absolutely, absolutely. And also the asylum office is supposed to be a place where the asylum seeker would feel protected. That's amazing.
Have you heard about arrests or detentions being made at asylum offices or other places where people are placing their faith in the government and the institution so that they can be processed fairly?
Never heard anything about a person being arrested from the asylum office, not even from the lobby area, from inside the asylum office, because according to Omar's attorney, he said that ICE came inside the building, inside the area. There's like three areas. There's the check-in area, and there is a lobby, and there's the inside, which is the offices of the asylum officers and the director of the office and all of that. And that made me wonder if the director was aware of this. Would she have any opportunity to object to it? I mean, I don't know. We don't know all of these details, but this is so unprecedented and so unheard of.
Do you know if there's a timeline for when Mr. Zidane will get his time in immigration court?
I do not know. But as of yesterday, as of last night when we checked, Mr. Zidane is still in the West County Detention Center in Richmond, in California.
Which has a reputation for not being the most pleasant place to stay.
Not at all. Not at all. Yeah.
And you, as an immigration consultant, what does something like this bring to your mind as you speak and advise other people who are like Mr. Zidane who may be seeking asylum?
I think the main thing is like we are trying to make people feel comfortable with what's happening now, but they cannot be comfortable because this is really a scary time in America. We feel that our immigrant communities are like under siege. Many are scared, many are fearful of doing anything. And I hear that like some people are not even going to the asylum office for their interviews now for fear of being arrested or, you know, for any reason that ICE can think of. And these people have been waiting for these interviews for years. So to miss that just because of fear, that's really not good, you know. So I would just recommend to people to, you know, consult with their lawyers. Also, get active and get engaged in the effort to, you know, combat these orders and these actions by ICE and by the current U.S. government against the immigrant communities.
That's Sudanese attorney and immigration consultant Jamila Abdelhalim. She spoke with KALW's Ben Trefney. You can find more about Omar Zeidan's case at KALW.org. Click Cross Currents. You're listening to Cross Currents from KALW News. I'm Hannah Baba. Girls of color who attend Oakland Unified Schools don't feel safe from sexual harassment or assault, according to a recent report. In focus groups, many girls shared similar experiences of unwanted touching, name-calling, and a feeling that they had nowhere to turn for help. And African-American girls said when they tried to stand up for themselves, they often got punished. The report helped spur a district initiative to provide safe spaces for Black girls to share common experiences. It also led to a significant overhaul last spring of the district's sexual harassment policy. The policy applies applies to all students of all ethnicities and gender identities. But by many indicators, African American girls have struggled the most. So in this age of Me Too, education reporter Lee Romney asked some girls from Skyline, Oakland Unity, and McClyman's high schools to share their own stories.
Almost every corner you turn, you could hear a bully calling a girl a hoe. I have never heard a teacher ever say, hey, don't call her a hoe. I ain't never heard that. That is very sad because I feel like teachers are there to, like, teach us the background of all this stuff and to put a stop to it, like, you know, because they're educators. I would be walking to class and, like, I wouldn't want to be bothered or anything. And somebody would come up to me and hug me. I'd be like, okay, like, enough, it's enough, like, stop hugging me, you know? And then they'll keep hugging me, and, like, won't let me go. When it, like, then it gets to a point, like, okay, I said stop, like, stop, you know? African-American girls, like, it happens to us so often, like, it's just a part of our daily lives. So if it didn't happen, I feel like it'll be, like, weird, but I feel like we would be able to walk around the school, like, without our backpacks hanging down low to cover us, or, like, you know, having to be aware of who's around you all the time.
When we wear certain clothing, we get in trouble for it, but when others wear it because they don't have as much, like, assets as we do, they don't get in trouble for it. I wore leggings to school, and I guess we're not supposed to, but a lot of the Latino girls wear leggings and they don't get in trouble for it. And I had to get in school suspension, and I didn't find it fair. I've been, like, sexually touched without permission. Like, there was this guy and he would slap my butt, and you'd think it was like okay, because, like, for a while I'll just let it happen and I'll just laugh it off, but I eventually got tired of it and I spoke out against him, and he got, like, offended and really mad about it, and we had to have a mediation. They tried to, like, put it on me for, like, acting out. We had a talk with the principal and we discussed, like, our issues about it, and we came to a common ground that whenever I'm feeling uncomfortable about something, I would go and ask the person and tell them I'm feeling uncomfortable. I do think my school tries to listen more because, like, we're small. And I feel like if I was at a bigger high school, I wouldn't have got the same outcome that I did as being at a charter school. I think it can be solved. Talking to us, asking us, like, having a circle or, like, some type of mediation with us and, like, see our opinions and our views on things and then try to change and address it.
As long as you don't take it to, oh, girl, you looking real good, girl, them shorts, da-da-da. Don't say that, because this is my body. Don't talk about my body. This isn't your body. I don't say anything about when you take your shirt off, when you walk around the school, or when you got your little basketball shorts on. Don't nobody say nothing to you, so don't say nothing to me, or don't touch me. And a lot of the times when I voice my opinion, it's not so much PG-13. I get a little frantic. I'll let my mind go out. Usually when it comes to teachers here, the argument can be going on for so long. And if they hear somebody yell, that's when they want to butt in. And I feel like that's when they'll be like, well, you're too loud, get out of my class. The whole time you've been in class, you've been hearing me going back and forth with this student. Why haven't you butt in then? Why didn't you speak up then? You should be the one to speak up about your classroom because you are the teacher.
I feel like we go through most more than average because, you know, like, we have to get to school, get from school. Then you have to worry about things that go on inside the environment of education. I know, like, in my neighborhood, it's always old men that try to stop and talk to me, or they try to stop and act like, I think they think that, I don't want to say the word, but they think I'm a prostitute or something. So that really gets to me. And inside of school, one day I came to school with a skirt on. It was kind of short, but my mom approved, so that's what it was. It was approved by my mom, so I didn't really care. And when I got there, like, the adults in the building now were making comments were the men. And I don't like when men comment about what I have on because that makes me very uncomfortable. Because you're a grown man, like, I don't understand why you're looking at me. It feels like, you know, that a grown man is watching me or looking at me, whatever I do. Like, I feel like I understand that some people, like, they want to look out for us, you know, because we have the problems coming to school, getting to school. But you're creating more by, like, feel like someone's approaching you about what you have on. That's worse. It's uncomfortable. I know it's uncomfortable for me.
When I was younger, like, at a very young age, I was, like, sexually assaulted. So I'm already very uncomfortable with my body since then. So, like, for people to look at me in a sexual way, like, it's, like, very uncomfortable to me because it's already happened to me before as I was younger. And then today, it happened to me. I wore a shirt. It was, like, kind of shortcut. And I'm having a conversation with an adult, and he's just making eye contact. Then he looked down at my chest. He make eye contact. Then he looked down at my chest. Like, and it made me very uncomfortable because it's, like, someone who I, like, have a bond with. And so for them to, like, look at me like that, nobody knows what they talk about, like, behind closed doors. So, like, they're to no longer be trusted. It make me feel uncomfortable because, yeah, it's predominantly male, and it's only one lady here that I could talk to and let them know what's going on. And I feel like it should be more women that we could reach out and talk to about stuff like this. Because you can't go to a dude and be like, oh, such and such said this about my boobs, or such and such touched me here. It's sometimes a joke to them, but it's a serious problem with me.
A boy have said something, like, very, like, nasty to me. Like, he had told me, like, ooh, your boobs take a bit. Can I touch him? And I'm like, touch him? What? No. Like, I just felt very disrespected. And he shouldn't have said that. Like, I feel like the teachers really should pay attention to stuff like this. Like, we go through stuff every day, walking to school, walking from school, walking down the street to the store and all of this. Like, we're always getting catcalled no matter where we're at. In general, being an African-American woman, I feel like we're sexualized the most because, like, we're born with a lot of stuff. Like, we got the booty, the boobs and all of this, but I don't feel like we should be sexualized because that's something that we can't help, you know? Like, we always had puberty talk in middle school and stuff like that, but I feel like we, like, now, as in being in high school, we need to have, like, talks on how to respect women and how to treat a woman, you know?
Those were the voices of 15-year-old Chrisiana Vaughn from Skyline High School and 17-year-old Alexis Foreman from Oakland Unity High School. Both participate in a Girls Inc. group at East Oakland's Concordia Park. And we heard from four of the McClymonds High School Fly Girls.
5, 6, 7, 8. Fly Girls, first love yourself. Fly Girls is a group designed to teach young ladies to love yourself no matter what.
They are 16-year-olds DeLasia White and Tamia Holmes, and 17-year-olds Najee McDonald and Gianna Smith.
As Fly Girls, we are committed to our education, community, and sisterhood. As a Fly Girl, we will respect each other, support one another, and love each other in spite of our differences.
Fly!
That segment was produced by KALW education reporter Lee Romney. You can reach her at education@kalw.org. This is Cross Currents. I'm Hannah Baba. After hearing from girls in Oakland high schools about a culture of harassment, the question is, what's being done about it? Well, one person working to combat the problem is Nzinga Duga. She heads a program at OUSD called African American Girls Excellence. She helped craft the district's new sexual harassment policy, and she works with schools to create environments where girls are not only heard, but also feel safe. We caught up with Nzinga yesterday in her office. So we just heard from some African American high school girls detailing
their daily struggle with harassment. In your first 100 days in office, you did this listening tour, and you went around the district kind of just listening to people, trying to determine what the issues are. Is this something you heard a lot?
Yeah, so when we did our listening tour for high schools, we focused on Skyline and McClymonds, and then we did some individual interviews of high school girls. But what was interesting to me was the similarity in stories, and the first thing I logged in my notes, in my qualitative notes, was the overpunishment. And what struck me was when the girls kept saying that we were targeted and touched inappropriately, and then we were punished for what happened to us. Mm-hmm. And one of the young ladies said that I was essentially sitting in my seat and the boy touched me inappropriately. And so I told him to stop. And then he touched me again, and I told him to stop. And I went and told the teacher. And then the teacher essentially told, you know, reprimanded both of them, as if both were doing it. So the third time he touched her inappropriately, she hit him. And so the teacher removed her from class and sent her to one of the leaders on campus. But there was another young lady who didn't like what was going on, so she stuck up for that young lady. She defended her. And so she was sent out of class. The school leader was processing, and we all do processing, and you know, how'd you feel and what was going on? And what the young lady said is, I felt disrespected and dishonored, and the teacher didn't even want to hear my side. And so the school leader was processing and processing and processing. And for me, I had enough. I just said, this is over processing. There's a situation. And I said, excuse me, I'm not attempting to interrupt, but I actually need for you to go take care of this.
And when you heard that and kind of gathered your data, what next? What were you going to do?
So one of the things I wanted to do in the campaign is make people aware that this is going on, because I was so surprised to see that people do not understand the plight of Black girls. And if they do, I'm not sure if they appreciate it. And so our biggest thing after listening is to continue to have like youth forums, conversations at schools, to talk to girls and then the teachers and the counselors and the advisors that support girls, and to kind of really begin to create a think tank. Because one thing that I learned is we need other, in particular, women leaders and then non-women leaders to actually come together and look at ways that we are supporting girls. So listening and then making the issue and the concern heard amongst the community. So that was step one. And then step two, what I'm trying to do, and we'll see how this goes, is I really believe in having a commission on the status of girls. So I proposed that to a principal. I'm waiting to see what he says, but I'm going to follow up this week to say, I gave you the idea, you liked it, but how about if primarily girls and some older adults come together and they talk about these issues, they come up with strategies and an action plan, they present it to the principal and leadership, and then we implement that over the course of a year and then test to see if we actually accomplish what we said we're going to accomplish.
Mm. So even the adult world right now, right, is wrestling with this issue. What are you hoping these girls will learn now at a young age that will help them into adulthood?
So I have a daughter, and I've raised nephews. And what I know about, there comes a period in your life where the young people teach. They teach the older people. Because we've been in a particular generation where some things have been seen as all right, and they're not all right. And so what I'm hoping for is that as the young people begin to teach, it's the best teacher for adults, because sometimes as peers to peers, we don't want to be chastised or we don't want to be pointed out. But I think what we can do is we can create a culture of learning and understanding and support. And it makes it okay and safe for the adults to say, actually, this is not tolerable. But not only that, we're going to teach you what is the right behavior. So one of the things I'm very interested in doing is to have workshops on what it means to be an ally, but also what it means to change your behavior. Because I can say, just in my own experience here, there have been things that have been said that appear to be a joke, and they're not a joke, and it feels uncomfortable. But I think women have to teach men. I've seen workshops where men are going in and they're teaching men, which there's this notion when you're doing this work of change and this work of diversity and transformational work that white folks would teach white folks, women would teach women, men would teach men. But I don't know if I accept that premise totally, because if the person who's being harmed is not getting in the room with the person who is either unconsciously or consciously doing the harm, how do you know the impact of the harm? So I think men have to be open to women coming in and talking about the impact of harm. I think if we're an educational institution, then the first folks that have to be willing to be educated are those who say that we are teachers. And I believe in lifelong learning. I believe in change and evolution. And I think when the youth tell the story, it is going to make a huge difference on how we shift behavior, particularly adult behavior.
That's Nzinga Duga. She heads the African American Girls Excellence Program in the Oakland Unified School District. This is local musician Anna Hilberg. You can catch her playing this Thursday at the Octopus Literary Salon in Oakland. Show starts at 7 o'clock. For Cross Currents, I'm Hannah Baba.